Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to share with you an aspect of the Dhamma that I've really been working with the last several months, and many months actually, and that's my relationship to speech. My struggles with it, my aspirations for it, and a lot of the teaching aspects within Theravadin Buddhism about it. I'm going to just start with a paragraph that I found in a book by Thich Nhat Hanh. And this book, I really love. It's called For a Future to be Possible. And it's a compendium about his works with the five training precepts. And it goes like this. The fourth precept: aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I vow to learn to speak truthfully with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain, and not to criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord, or that can cause the family or the community to break. I will make all efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. That really sums up everything I want to say tonight. Gil invited me to speak tonight as part of my training in the chaplaincy program through the Sati Center. And if any of you have any questions about this program, I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it in the question part of this talk or at the end of the talk tonight. And when he invited me to talk, he said, you know, sometimes other students are so interested in hearing how each other got involved in the path and their sort of course on along it. And I thought, well, that would be sort of a long, boring talk tonight. But there's one aspect that I thought would be really interesting to share and for you to hear about, and that's how I met Gil Fransdal and became involved and acquainted with IMC. Because it really ties into this aspect of right speech. It's really what hooked me in here, actually. And so, just to give you a quick little thumbnail, I started meditating before I got my driver's license. And just in the months preceding my driver's license, actually, my boyfriend drove me to a house in Palo Alto where a monk from India was initiating people in Ananda Marga meditation. And it was, you know, the early 70s, and it was a really exciting time around here. And that practice was wonderful for me. It was filled with really ascetic practices and a lot of austerities, and a lot of ritual, a lot of mantras, and a lot of exercises that just completely take you out of your body and put you in sort of a blissful state. And so I lived most of my teenage years and my young adulthood in that place, and practiced that way on and off for many years, and in the meantime sort of had a family and so on and so forth. Went to college, went to parts of medical school, blah, blah. So then my friend Priscilla in 1978 really challenged me. And she said, you know, you blissful bunny, why don't you come down here with us real people and go to a Vipassana retreat with me? And I thought, piece of cake, 10 days. I mean, you guys only meditate for 45 minutes at a time. This will be, you know, okay, if you want me to come, I'd love to go. And she put me in the car and drove me to Santa Rosa, and I had just this unbelievable good fortune to be meditating with Joseph Goldstein and the cadre of teachers that comes with him from the East Coast or from Hawaii every year. That was, Stephen Smith was there, and Sharon Salzberg, and Joseph, and it was just the most amazing experience. It was so difficult to be in my body on a cushion for 45 minutes at a time and not be able to sort of move the energy out and up and be gone. So to sit with things as they were, I found to be just this sort of radical, revolutionary practice, and one which I really recognized that would be incredibly valuable for me. And when I met Joseph, I thought, this man is like radically empty and radically kind at the same time. I felt totally hooked by his teachings and the teachings of the teachers with him. So I spent many years going to his 10-day retreat, you know, but not really being a Buddhist, sort of wondering if I wasn't a Hindu or maybe even a Sufi, and wondering, you know, about it. But over the years, really, this Buddhist practice of awareness and sitting and watching the rising and passing of phenomenon really astonished me, and I think sort of grounded me. In fact, a nun from Ananda Marga came to my house and she said, "Finally, you're a real person." You know, I mean, so I was flipped out. I was spaced out even for the Margis. Anyway, the years went by, and about 4 years ago, I heard about IMC from my friend Michael, who said, "This teacher in Palo Alto is fabulous. You've got to meet this guy." So I called, I think I must have called the center and just said that I was now in my family's printing business, and if there was ever any little printing job that needed to be done, I'd be really happy to volunteer it. It would be a nice way of supporting Gil's teaching. And so I don't even think I met anybody. You might have sent me something over in the mail, or maybe we had some little email connection or something. Anyway, I did this mailing job, and it was very nice, and we did it, and I put it in the mail and didn't think too much about it. And a few weeks later, someone at my office said, "Kim, there's a man down in the lobby, this man named Gil, and he's here to see you." And I really had no idea who this would be. I mean, I didn't put it in my mind together at all with the teacher from the center. And I went downstairs, and there was Gil Fronsdahl. I don't think I had ever met him. I think I had seen him give a talk once with Joseph in Palo Alto. And he had brought me a book, and he was going, I think, up to the Zen Center or somewhere. He had stopped by just to give me this book and to say thank you. And I was really astonished by this, that someone would take the time out of his busy schedule to visit someone he didn't know to say thank you for this little thing. And I was also really shy, and so I said, "Would you like to go out into the floor and see how everybody did this job, you know, where it was printed and where it was mailed?" And like, "I don't want to have to talk to you, but would you like to? I'd love to spend a little time. You want to just go out here and see it?" And Gil said, "Sure, he'd love to." And we went out on the floor, and in the middle of this busy, you know, pretty big office building, he stopped at every machine with me and asked the operator what it was they did and how they did it. And the way he made contact with every person on the floor astonished me. I mean, people just completely, people really heard that he was interested in what they did, and people were giving these huge descriptions of how the inserting machines worked and how the Cytex addressed this stuff and how the plates were developed. And at every place that he stopped, he really stopped and he made this contact with people. And I thought, gosh, I was really amazed. I heard more from people in that context, really, than I had from them just telling me what they were doing on a daily basis. And I was really moved and touched, and I thought, I really want to get to know this teacher better. I mean, he really, I felt, had given me such a profound teaching on the floor of my workshop. It was really astonishing to me. So I got a little bit more involved, happily, with IMC, and then sort of luck got me involved with being in Gil's DPP group and getting a little bit more involved. And in that DPP group, I started hearing more about Sati Center phenomenon and classes. And then it turned out that Paok Sayadaw, this Burmese teacher, was giving a little workshop here. And so it was here in this room I came, and I met this Burmese teacher. I knew nothing about Southeast Asia. I'd never been to the East. And I met a teacher who I felt like, gosh, I've known this man for my whole lifetime and more. It was like I came home to family in this room with this man. And he said, "Well, I'm getting sort of old, and I think you should come to Burma." So within 9 months, I had gotten all the shots that a person can humanly take, I have to say, and loaded huge suitcases full of stuff that I didn't need over in Burma. But I was ready to go, and I got on an airplane and went to sit with Sayadaw in outside of Malamyang in the forest, in a jungle monastery in Burma for 3 months. And when I came back from that experience, the chaplaincy program was starting, and I had this wonderful opportunity to be back down here because the DPP program was just finishing up when I got back, and then I luckily had this chaplaincy program that sounded really interesting, so I could maintain my contact with IMC. I live in Berkeley, so it's sort of far to come down for Dharma talks, but I've been really working it out in my mind how I can come down here on a more regular basis, because I feel so comfortable down here at this little center. Anyway, so now I'm in the chaplaincy program, and that's great. And in the meantime, my sayadaw said he really wanted to come to America and teach a retreat. So I said, no problem. I'll organize one for you. So I just we just finished a two-month retreat in the hills behind Calistoga that we put together and managed to survive. So it takes a lot to put on a two-month retreat, I found out. And at that time, an American woman who was attending the retreat said she wanted to ordain as a nun. And when I asked our senior nun in Burma if that would be possible, she said that would be fine, but if she did it, I had to do it too, because that would only be fitting. So I just had the wonderful opportunity of spending 2 months as a Theravadin 10 precept nun in the hills of Calistoga. It was great. Anyway, that's sort of what I've been doing in Theravada Buddhism. But at that retreat, before I went on retreat, Inez called to schedule my little talk that Gil had said would be part of my training, and this is my first Dharma talk. So I said to Inez, she said, what do you want to talk about? You know, do you want to talk about yourself? And I said, no. Let's think of a good topic. I said, I want to talk about right speech. And she said, that would be great. And then I scared myself and I said, oh, no, I don't want to talk about right speech. I want to talk about something I'm really good at. How about generosity? That one I know. But right speech, I'm terrible, terrible. And Inez said, it's got to be right speech. It's got to be something you need to work on. I've got a quote here. I wrote it down. She said, I quote, she said, no, do right speech. Do something you are working on. It will be more helpful to you. Really wonderful teaching, because it's astonishing. I've spent the last 3 months, of course, 2 months I was in retreat, but I've spent the last three and a half months really, really thinking about my relationship to right speech. And it's really sort of been astonishing to me how a medium that we use so very much we're often so not aware of. So it's been sort of uplifting and horrifying and really edifying.
Are you using the word right speech?
I am using right speech. I probably shouldn't use right speech. I should just say my relationship to speech, period.
What do you mean by right speech?
Right speech would be the precept, which I'll get to, which is technically called right speech. But thank you. Yeah, really just my relationship to the spoken word, both as a receiver of it and as the purveyor of speech. And then, of course, the media, you know, listening to the radio and reading the news and so on and so forth. But really, when we think about it, we just spend an enormous amount of time involved in this activity. And at the end of the retreat, although my retreat with Sayadaw was about concentration practice, and I'm a good concentrator because I've been doing it since I was a kid, what really became true for me was my deep commitment to these training principles, these five precepts that we have in lay life, which I'll describe in a minute, but most specifically the precept of how we use speech, because I talk a lot, and I need to really pay attention to what that's about for me. So I'm going to share that with you tonight. So I've got, you know, some great quotes, I think, about it and some thoughts from other people and a nice little Jataka tale to tell you about right speech. But first I want to just read a quote from Stephen Batchelor, because he writes in his book Buddhism Without Beliefs, which I think is just a fabulous little book if anybody wants to read it. He says, the resolve to awaken requires the integrity not to hurt anyone in the process. Dharma practice cannot be abstracted from the way we interact with the world. Our deeds, words, and intentions create an ethical ambiance that either supports or weakens resolve. And then the last quote I want to quote for a while, I don't know where this came from, but this also sums things up. The power of speech is a unique gift of man. It is a power which, when used properly, brings harmony, happiness, and wisdom. If it is abused, it can bring ignorance, delusion, pain, and deceit. Right speech is about controlling the abuse of speech and cultivating its best potentials. Students of the Eightfold Path learn to control their words. They avoid lies, tale-bearing, harsh words, and nonsense, while practicing speaking truth, gentle words, and speaking sensibly and meaningfully. So teachings about speech are really intertwined throughout all of the Theravadin teachings. I mean, the Buddha thought speech was so important, he made it part of his Eightfold Path. And because it's so intertwined with all of these aspects, it gives a great reason to sort of review a little bit of basic numerical Buddhism, which I'm always forgetting. So just the thing, you know, the reason there is numerical Buddhism, of course, is because it was an oral tradition long ago. And when Saito Paok was teaching us for 2 months, he kept doing things with his hands, like he would enumerate 1, 2. They have, like, even in the old days, they kept track of what point they were on with their hands. It was really quite fun to watch. But I don't have that many points to make, so I don't need to do that. But the Eightfold Path comes from the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha realized. Let's just back up a tiny bit. You know, 2,600 years ago, there was this prince, and he saw some things that made him leave his princely palace and wander out into the forest to try and understand what he had seen. And he underwent all these really rigorous austerity practices that were akin to sort of some of the things I'd been doing in Ananda Marga, I think, because they were based in the Hindu Vedas. And then after 7 or 8 years of that, he realized this just wasn't getting him anywhere. He probably should eat and then try and meditate a little bit. So he took some nourishment and he started practicing under a Bodhi tree, in which is now Bodh Gaya, India. And through the night, he made this resolve to really understand the truth as it really is, to understand things as they really are. And at the end of that evening, he understood completely what we call the Four Noble Truths. And he taught that for the next 35 years, or was it 45 years, this path of following these Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are, one, that in this life, there's going to be suffering. Stephen Batchelor calls it anguish. I really love that translation of the word. Some people call it stress. Tanisara Biko, I think, calls it stress. But anyway, inherently, in conditioned phenomenon, there's going to be suffering, more or less. And the suffering comes from clinging to things and wanting them to stay as they are, and maybe also from pushing things away and not wanting them to be the way they are. So that's the second noble truth. And the third noble truth is that there can be an end to this suffering because we let go of craving and aversion and we become enlightened, which would be so great. And that's nibbana, that's liberation, to really be free of this craving and aversion. And the fourth noble truth is that the Buddha has outlined, Argautama Buddha has outlined this path for attaining this state, which is the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path. And so important is speech that he made it one of his Eightfold Path aspects. In the Eightfold Path, there are these three categories, sort of like the food pyramid, you know, or the old food pyramid, maybe, because now we've turned it on its side and we have it lying like this. But anyway, the old food pyramid went like this. And in Theravada Buddhism, that's the way sort of I see it, is that these three principles at the bottom are how we live in the world, sort of the morality factor, which I think of as the integrity factor, really. And speech is one of those. Speech and right livelihood and right action. So the one I'm really, really interested in right now is in right speech. So that's the one I want to talk about a little bit more. And right speech, just to say something about a little bit about the precepts, the way the precepts are connected to this Eightfold Path is we've got these ways of developing our integrity. One is right speech. And then we've got training rules as lay people in Theravadin Buddhism, and they sort of intertwine. And one of the training rules is also right speech. So that's why I called it right speech before. There's a wonderful Mahasi teacher, Upandita Sayadaw, and he's written a book that I think is just a fabulous, fabulous book, and I actually took it to Paok Monastery with me last year, and it really helped me a lot. It's called In This Very Life, and it's a compendium of talks that he gave in Barre, Massachusetts, maybe 30 years ago. And I read them all the time, and it always teaches me something. But he talks about right speech as an avoidance of wrong speech. which classically sometimes in Theravadan Buddhism, the precepts are like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, you know, rather than don't do this, let's aspire to this. And someone like Thich Nhat Hanh has really filled it out, the positive, wonderful aspects of all of these training rules. But Upandita Sayadaw was saying, don't avoid crooked behaviors, he calls them, unwholesome behaviors with speech. And the four unwholesome behaviors are: one, don't lie. Two, don't engage in maligning anyone. Gossip, that's what it is. Malicious gossip or maligning someone. Three, the third one. Well, the last one is just don't fritter away your speech like I'm doing right now. And the other one is what? Let's see, there's don't lie. Harsh, coarse, and crude speech. Thank you so much. Yeah. So avoid those things. And that would be what the prohibition about this kind of speech would be. And I can see, you know, how many, and the reason that he really encourages people to avoid crooked behavior, in classic Theravadan Buddhism, there's a real reason to it, because they say that when you're engaged in these kind of negative behaviors, you're laying down a lot of mental mind moments, a lot of rupa kalapas, they're going to call them later on, but these things have like a karmic stream to them. And they may bite you this lifetime, but they may also bite you for lifetimes to come if you believe in lifetimes to come. So he feels that when you do these sort of unwholesome behaviors, you create this unwholesome stream of consequence. I mean, it's obvious. If you say something bad about someone and they hear it, you hurt their feelings, and then they get mad at you, and there's an immediate, or not so immediate, but pretty quick effect you can see. Or like me, you say something bad about someone, they don't necessarily have to hear about it, but then you just fret for days about, why did you do that? I mean, and you can just spend so much of your time feeling a lot of remorse, which in Buddhism is actually a very unhealthy mind state, because it's not productive and it just sets up more negativity. So they really help you to see that it's probably best not to engage in behaviors that you're going to have a lot of these unwholesome responses to, and sit long retreats thinking, oh God, that conversation I had with my mother before I came here was so horrible, and she said this and I said that, and the consequences of it are just so unpleasant, really, and unproductive. People have taken those precepts and they've talked about then what some of the negative effects of unwholesome speech or crooked speech are. Then they talk about what some of the wholesome consequences of good speech are, you know, of what potential we have with good speech. I mean, good speech can foster connection. Good speech can really, you can connect with another human being and really help alleviate their suffering or your suffering just by making that connection with words. If you're really listening carefully, you really can form an empathic link with them. There's a transcendent, actually, aspect of the precepts when you're on this path, as we are, wanting to be free, and that is to use speech in the most wholesome of ways to speak the truth, to learn the truth, and to communicate the truth. And in the Jataka tales, it's said that a bodhisattva, you know, a person who's made a commitment 100,000 million lifetimes ago to become the future Buddha and has all these successive lives training for it, can break all the other precepts, but they can't break the precept about right speech. And they can't lie. They can't even lie to save their life. And people say that perhaps this is because lying really is like killing the Dharma. I mean, if what we're talking about, I think Robert Aitken said that, right speech is really not killing the Dharma. Because as Buddhists, or as Buddhist practitioners, or as people who want to be free, no matter what you call yourself, the idea is to know what's true and to be able to live in that truth. And so if you lie, it's just so contradictory and so silly. And We do it all the time in little ways. So after not killing, right speech is, not killing and honoring life, right speech is considered probably the most important training precept that we have. When I was in Burma, or I think either when I was in Burma or on this retreat, Sister Cecilia, a Malaysian nun, told me a great Jataka tale that reinforces this idea, and I thought I would share it with you if you're interested. The Jataka tales are, as I said, sort of legends about when the Buddha was in training to be the Buddha. And, you know, whether you believe that or not, they're still great, great training stories. And this one is about the time when the Buddha was a mendicant called Suttasoma. And he lived, you know, a really long time ago. And he came up against a guy that we later knew as Angulimala. I don't know if you know who Angulimala is. He's the murderer at the time of the Buddha who was murdering people and cutting off their fingers to make a finger necklace because some horrible, really bad teacher, he got involved with the wrong teacher, told him to make this necklace. You got to be careful of what teachers you pick, really. Anyway, when he came up against the Buddha to try and kill the Buddha and get his finger, the Buddha stopped him in his tracks. And actually, Angulimala became a fully realized being at the time of the Buddha. It just goes to show, you never know who you're meeting up with on the road. But, you know, his unsavory behaviors notwithstanding. In an earlier life, he was still an unsavory guy. And he was the prime minister of a country or an area, and he had the bad habit of killing people and eating them. Really not so good. And when his constituency, I mean, not like unlike some politicians, anyway, I shouldn't say that, that's probably not right speech. His constituency found out about this unwholesome behavior and they banished him to the forest. And unfortunately, as people who passed through the forest found out, he continued this behavior along the side of the road there. Anyway, Suttasoma, our future Buddha, had just showered and was coming through the forest because he had made a commitment to a Brahmin in the village to give an important Dharma teaching. And he's walking through the forest and when he's grabbed from behind by this ogre and pulled up really high. And because he was still wet from his shower, some water fell on the ogre, who sort of said, "Aha! You're so afraid of me, you're so afraid of dying that you're crying, you're sweating." And he said, "No, no, actually I'm not. I just took my bath, and if you wouldn't mind putting me down, I have some important Dharma work to do." And he said, "No, you don't get it. You're my lunch." And the future Buddha, our Suttasoma, said, "You know, I understand what you're saying, and I made this commitment to go give this really important Dharma talk. How about if you let me go? It's lunchtime, I'll be back by dinner. I'll be back in the evening." And the ogre said, "Ah, why, you really think I'm so stupid that I'd let you go and you'd go to the village and you would come back to be eaten?" And Suttasoma said to this character, "Don't you recognize me? Don't you see me? I've been your teacher for how many lifetimes? You've forgotten who I am. You know I never tell lies. You know it's impossible for me to tell a lie. If you let me go to the village to fulfill my Dhamma, I will come back and you can do with me what you want." This so unnerved the ogre. I mean, it would be scary. I mean, if someone said that to you, you'd really have to think twice about who you were dealing with. So this ogre said, let Suttasoma go into the village where he actually fulfilled his Dhamma talk. And in the evening, he returned to the forest. And he said to the ogre, "Okay, as I promised you, and I can't lie, can't go against what I've said, I'm here, do with me what you will." And the ogre was so completely overcome, like I was at the Cytex inserting machine, he basically said, "You know, I honor you, you know, I want to learn from you." And he made the commitment not to eat any more human beings, and became such a mensch, such a good guy, that the people in the village heard about this guy out in the forest who was doing good things and invited him back to be the prime minister, which is the kind of happy ending, you know, happy ending we all like in one of these kind of tales. Let's see here. I have a quote, just one line, that really grabbed me. Good speech is spoken at the right time, in accordance with truth, gently, purposely, and with a friendly heart. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Good speech is spoken at the right time, in accordance with truth, gently, purposely, and with a friendly heart. So this has been my teaching the last 3 months. Because for me, what this goes to the core of is that speech is a vehicle for all these mind states we have. You know, it's not just that speech happens. Speech is just a vessel, a vehicle for a mind state that we have, for an intention that we hold, for an impulse that we can or can't control. Speech just is the messenger of this. And speech is what I saw in Gil, you know, 4 years ago when he was standing at the Cytex or the inserting machines. It was his heart that was being transmitted through these questions that he was asking that really compelled me. So I've been really trying to understand, well, what is it? How do we control this? You know, not even control, how do we work with this speech thing that happens, you know? And not only does speech happen, you know, not only is speech like the vehicle for these mind states, but speech also conditions our mind states. Because, like, if we have a kindness, if we say something genuinely kind, but a simple thing to someone, and they have some kind of positive response, it sort of sets up this operant conditioning, you know? I mean, it reinforces our kindness. Or when we make an empathic connection with someone and we can see what effect that has on them, it's so sort of astonishing and sort of, it's just astonishing, really. And I think it conditions our hearts to appreciate and honor that empathic way of being. So both speech is a messenger and it's a conditioner of our minds and our hearts. Just, and it reminded me, you know, I went to medical school for a couple of years, and there was a guy at UCSF who was studying facial expressions. I think his name was Eccles, isn't it? And he would study smiling. He would have people hooked up, and he'd just tell them to smile, and then he studied their actual neurochemical response, and it changed. I mean, it released all these endorphins just from the physical smiling. And I've been thinking that when we act with this integrity in our speech or with these other precepts, you know, when I take a spider out of my bathtub before I fill it up, probably shouldn't use so much water, but that's another precept. It conditions us. And the idea is, in Pa'auk system, and I think in classical Buddhism, is that when we have this base of integrity and we become more refined, because, you know, it is a sort of a refinement of our behavior, of our way of looking at the world, then it lends to the power of the concentration that we can develop, because our minds aren't pulled off with, oh God, I shouldn't have said this, or I shouldn't have done that, or I took that and it wasn't really mine, you know. And when we've developed this power of concentration, then we can go to Vipassana and really penetrate the truth of how things are. So starting with this little, you know, kind thing we said, it just has this enormous chain of reaction that can end with our liberation. It's really exciting to me. I mean, if I can practice that just in the most simple way, then maybe, you know, the result will be this. And I just read a great quote by Joan Halifax. It really doesn't have a whole lot to do with this, except when I think of this chain, it seems like such a long shot, you know. And she said something like, enlightenment is an accident waiting to happen, and when we practice, we just put ourselves in the way of that accident, or something like that. It's like it's, you know, we just want to make ourselves more available to it, right? We want to make our minds more ready to really see truth as it really is. So that line for me is really powerful. So how do we do it? I'm sure all of you would have something you could tell me that would help me. Some of the things I read in the literature and some of the things I've reflected on, of course, in my own life are It all comes really down to mindfulness. I mean, how aware are we when we speak of what we're saying? Or how aware are we of what our motivation really is? You know, and it's not even necessarily what we actually say with the words, but how do we say it, you know? Like if I say, oh, you're looking really good today, you know, or and what am I trying to tell someone? Or, you know, or I really like you, but I'm really not even, you know, what am I really communicating? So it all comes back to how mindful we are and how able we are to process that, which is really asking a lot of ourselves, obviously, especially in situations where we're tense or confused or angry or, you know, worked up in some way. Can we step back and see what the thread is, you know? If we're in a tense situation, can we step back and really let that other person express themselves till they're finished? Or do we have to argue with every point? Or like me, do we have this horrible habit of interrupting so someone can't even finish? This is the one thing I'm really trying to pay attention to right now in myself. You know, are our words there to build bridges, or are they there to compete or be aggressive with someone? And can we ask ourselves those questions in a way that allows us to maybe not every time hit it, you know, not every time be in that place, but can we reflect on it afterwards? Can we reflect on it a little bit? Every once in a while I would go into Sayadaw last month and I'd say, Sayadaw, I'm in the zone. I mean, I've really got this. I'm totally in the zone here, Sayadaw. And he'd look at me like, okay, you know. But I feel that way sometimes with speech, you know, like if you're really communicating with someone and you're really hearing them and you really feel understood, then you're like in this incredible zone of awareness happening, and it can be so exciting and wonderful. Is it almost time? I don't have much more. I'm just going to say a few things that I forgot to say, which is about the precepts, because I missed a whole area. You know, this issue of right speech is one of the precepts, one of the training rules, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls one of the wonderful training methods or rules that lay people in Buddhism are given. Because, you know, in monastic Buddhism, there are like 227 rules for men monks and 335 rules for fully ordained female monks. And then 10 precepts for us Tsilishin, these 10 precept nuns. And when we're on monastic retreats, there are 8 precepts. And when we get out of all that, when we're in our regular life, they ask, you know, the Buddhist community to practice 5 precepts. And those precepts are a wonderful opportunity, really, to examine our lives. They're, one, not to kill, to honor life, to honor all life, and not to kill. But not just to kill, but, you know, you can kill a connection, you know, by not actually physically killing someone, but honoring life and honoring connection. That would be number one. Number two, to really respect the resources you need, and not to take things, not to steal things, and also not to take things you don't need. The third one is to practice sexual intelligence, to be appropriate sexually, and to honor one's sexuality and someone else's sexuality, other people's sexuality. The fourth one is musavada, is the right speech, is to use speech wisely and to refrain from not using speech wisely in all the ways that we've talked about, or that I've talked about tonight. And the fifth one is to not take intoxicants, which cloud the mind, which leads to problems with all of the above four, right? Because when you've had a few glasses of wine too many, or period, you know, those words pop out and you can't grab them fast enough to reel them back in, and, you know, all sorts of things can happen. So the idea would be, you know, to really watch probably the use of any intoxicant. That would be drugs, and I wonder if it's coffee. I don't know. I mean, I wonder if it's stimulants, because they get me talking a lot, and, you know, whatever. So that's our own definition of these things, which is what I love. I mean, the thing I love about Buddhism is, first of all, we don't have to believe anything. We just have to practice, really. We don't have to be Buddhists, we just have to try and be the Buddha. You know, I mean, we really have to figure out what's true for ourselves. And second of all, these aren't taskmaster rules. These are like a wonderful training ground. And they seem really simple, and they can be so simple, and they can be so complex. They can be anywhere you are with them, which is really quite astonishing and wonderful. Joseph Goldstein sums it up in about 4 words, which is so great about Joseph, and he'll tell you them 3 times so you won't forget them. About speech, Joseph says, asks, is it true and is it useful? And with all these words I've said tonight, for myself, I come back to that because I can remember those, especially being my age. You start forgetting things, as many of you might know. But I can remember, is it true and is it useful? So I'm using that, and I wanted to share that with you because I think Joseph's so great. As a demonstration of right speech, I would just like to share with you the Buddha's last words. Very simply, he said, all conditioned things are subject to decay. Strive on with diligence. So it's my aspiration with speech to connect, honor, and support myself and other people, and to refine my integrity, to develop my integrity, which I truly believe will support my practice and help me clearly begin to see things as they truly are. And although we've been told in classical Buddhism that if we behave in this way, if we refine our speech, we can like garnish wonderful outcomes like great wealth and great success and great regard and even great rebirths in the Brahma realms. But since I don't know if I believe any of that, I don't know all of that to be true. If I can just keep myself out of trouble on this plane, and if I can just really increase my ability to connect with other people and honor other people and support other people, I'll be so happy about my use of speech. I think that's all I really want to say about it. So thank you so much for listening to me. I mean, you've been really all practicing wonderful right speech right here with it, and I felt really comfortable sharing with you, so thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. And if you have any comments you want to make, or we've got 15 minutes, right? So if you have any thoughts you want to share about this topic, or any questions you want to ask about any of the activities I've been involved in, or... Yes?
Can you tell me what DPP is?
Yes. The DPP is a program that Spirit Rock organizes, and it's called the Dedicated Practitioners Program, and it's a year-long or 2-year-long program, and it actually touches on really wonderful bits of Dharma material that the group studies together, and then you get a homework buddy, and you get to study with a buddy, and there are retreats as well, about 5 a year. 5 a year, I think. Yeah.
No, 5 over 2 years.
5 over 2 years. You can go to the Spirit Rock website and get information about that. And Gil, is he still a DPP teacher? Or are they doing
it
right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just started again.
Yeah. Oh man, there's so many really with right speech. Like I was thinking on my way over here, have I talked about, like there's one great training exercise that Jack Kornfield wrote about somewhere. Can you spend a day or a weekend or a week not talking about someone who's not in your presence? Which it's really tricky. Okay, I talked about Gil, he's not here. Does that count? I don't know. I mean, you know, is it only if you say something bad about someone or if it's talking about anybody? But really, telling stories about other people is a is one for me. And sometimes my motivation or my intention might not be harmful, but then I think, well, the outcome of this could be really bad. You know, it's really maybe not my place to share those stories, especially if it's betraying a confidence. I mean, maybe someone doesn't know this person, but nonetheless. You know, of course, as a psychotherapist, I had years of holding people's confidence, and that was easy. That was like the law, you know? But as a regular person on the street, for me, that's a tricky one. So that one and the interrupting the frivolous speech, okay, that's a big one. Like, just to talk because it's fun.
An observation as a parent, the idea of not talking about someone who is not present seems like it can be very challenging. It seems like such a part of parenthood.
You mean talking about your kids with your partner? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, and that's why I think all of these precepts, in Thich Nhat Hanh's book, they have, you know, a lot of chapters of responses to the precepts, and you know, it's very interesting. There are a lot of good points raised about them. Like, I aspire to tell, this wasn't in the book, but okay, I aspire to tell the truth, and there's someone who comes in the room who really wants to hurt someone else, and that person's hiding, and they ask me, where is that person now? Do I tell the truth and have them go there? Or do I just say, I don't know, or I lie and say they went out the back door? Or you could say nothing, you know, but what's your own relationship to this is I guess, sort of the point. I think I'd say, oh, they went down the street. I wouldn't want someone to... So, that is it. Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. That's exactly right. Yeah. I think that's really true. And right and wrong is also very culturally based. Like in Japan, for example, a facet of scholarly Buddhism is that in Japan, you don't tell a person when they're dying. You just don't give them that information. Whereas in the U.S., you know, part of our popular culture is that we would want to know and that we would tell someone. But in the classical Buddhism of Japan, you don't tell them because you don't want them to get into a fearful mind state and maybe a whole bunch of other reasons. So I found this very interesting, and you just wrap your mind around, you know, things are different, and there are different levels and different experiences of the truth, aren't there?
You know, in Japan, I know at least a number of years ago, they wouldn't tell patients that they had cancer.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
And in our country, saying, like, a proper way to tell them, oh, you're dying or you have this kind of disease, it's not right. Even the doctor would suggest a family. And you have to, it's hard for family. You have to pretend that you're knowing nothing or it's not that serious.
What culture is that?
I'm a Chinese.
From Chinese culture, huh? You know, it's so interesting because on this retreat, there were a bunch of people, Thai people, who were telling me that in Thailand, they keep books. People write like books that they keep in case they're dying and no one knows them, because at the time of your death in Thailand, they want the truth spoken about you, about all the good things you've done. So they have these books, these merit books that they keep, because the truth in the Thai culture, and I think this would maybe go along maybe with the Burmese culture, is that in the moment that you're dying, you don't want to have remorse about all these things that you may have done. You have to let go of that. You really want to focus on all the wonderful things you've done. You know, I want to think about the fact that I could share this talk with you tonight, and I want to think about, you know, other positive things that will be of benefit to me as I develop, maybe, if there's any truth to any of that. So it's really interesting. In Thailand, people would be like getting their books ready, you know, and then the family would be coming telling everybody all the really wonderful things that they'd done and all the great things about them so that they could leave this earth in that mental state. So it really is so culturally determined also. Really, really saw that. We're going to end. Did you have something you wanted to say?
Oh, I was just going to say that one of the great supports for right speech, I need a whole lot more, but is getting comfortable with silence. You know, and having friends who are comfortable with silence so that it's okay to have these long gaps in conversation and not feel it in and fill it with nervous thoughts.
Can I comment on that? I was wondering if, I was going to ask you, when you first started practicing right speech, did you find that you had any sort of anxiety about certain relationships where you maybe had constructed sort of an identity for yourself of not using that, and then decided to switch over? You know, you're kind of like, well, how do I? I don't want to change. You have fear of changing the dynamic of your relationship with people.
Huh. That's really interesting. I haven't had that experience, but I could certainly imagine in a... and it's not too far from my experience. I used to use horribly coarse language when my kids were growing up. I don't know, I liked swearing. It's really embarrassing to admit it, but I would swear and my kids would have these code names for it. Oh, mom's going to have a fit. Well, anyway, they didn't call it that. But I don't swear anymore, and my children really like it. You know, I mean, I haven't sworn in a long time, but they'll come, they're adults now, and they come home and they say, remember when mom used to use that language? I mean, she swore like a sailor. I mean, my grandmother taught me every word one could imagine, and I thought, well, my grandma's taught me this. This is, you know, so, and it was dramatic and flamboyant. And now when I'm around people who use that kind of language, I'm really sort of surprised by it and so amazed that I could have talked like that, you know. It's really sort of astonishing, and I'm sure I relapse at times, you know. But as I say, I don't hold these as like rules that I'm knocked down the notches for, not holding up to. I mean, I really feel that they're just this amazing support for supporting how we want to live with integrity, you know, how we want to develop. So, but I could see that that could be an issue.
And I used to go to all the lunches and have this long complaint session, and that was the culture. Seeing that negativity, how it was affecting me, and I just lost interest in doing it, so I would just sit there in silence. There was no lunches, and I did feel myself just sort of, you know, I don't know, pulling apart from these people. You know.
I was with my husband this past weekend on a walk in Golden Gate Park for the National Association of the Mentally Ill. It was their first annual walk. It was really a beautiful event. And Gary's boss was there, who runs the mental health department in Alameda where he works. And she said, God, you know, when Gary first started working here, the things that he would say, I mean, he'd say something and we'd all look at each other and think, where is this man coming from? You know, he'd just come up with these sort of off-the-wall comments or sort of aggressive forms of speech. And she said, he's really changed. And he said, no, Mary, you're just used to me. And she said, no, really, your speech has changed. And I really know that to be true, that somehow when you're in an environment that encourages and supports and rewards you for a particular kind of behavior, you're more inclined to act in that way. And of course, that's why they talk about the incredible value of satsang, huh? You know, when you're with a group of people who are really committed to being free of greed, hatred, and delusion, there aren't too many pockets of society out there we can go to. I mean, let's face it. I mean, it's really sort of a radical, it's really a very radical idea to be free of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the value of shared company, where that's a commonly held idea, and we can still have a really good sense of humor about it, is a really sort of a wonderful thing. Thank you.